There's a chapel in Jerusalem, which is high above the city, in the Mount of Olives, and the name of the chapel is called Dominus Flavit. The Lord wept, because it was at this place that Jesus, as he was coming into Jerusalem, stood and overlooked the city and the people there. And his heart was moved with love, and he wept for them, because they were not going to realize their time of visitation, that the Lord was coming to them. And he wept for them, and his heart pursued them in prayer. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, if only you would recognize this, your time of visitation. This gospel, it begins with a line which can be something of a throwaway line. Jesus went up the Mount of Olives, and then early in the morning, he went down to the temple. And so it was early in the morning that he went down, and this whole gospel scene takes place. But he had spent the night at the Mount of Olives, the same place where his agony was, but the night before he died, presumably with his heart being moved in prayer and praying for those in sin as well. His heart pursuing them in prayer and tears likely falling from his eyes. And he comes down to the temple, and this scene unfolds. And three things about this gospel. First is the trap. Second is the scandal. And third is the last stone. Each part shorter than the last, I promise you. But first, the whole thing was a trap. From the very beginning to the end, this was a trap that they had set. And even many biblical scholars, and so it's not church teaching, but many biblical scholars see this, and they think as well that the woman herself was entrapped by this, that the trap was set for her as well, because the scholars, the scribes, the Pharisees, they didn't care so much about the sin or the law that was being broken. What they wanted more than anything else was to be able to trap Jesus and be done with him. To have a charge that they could bring against him so the Romans could do away with him. And so here they had set this trap. And this woman who had been used time and time and time again, the assumption is that they used her as well, setting the trap for her so that they could bring this to Jesus. Because having been caught in the act, they pulled just her to Jesus, and here was the trap they had thought they had had. That here they were going to pit Jesus between two laws and put him in a no-win situation. On one side, one wall, is the Jewish law, which clearly says that the couple caught in adultery is to be brought forward and they are to be put to death by stoning. Notice it's not the couple that's brought before him, it's just the woman, which leads credence to the theory that this was a trap for her as well as Jesus. She was just essentially being used. But that's the Jewish law. On the other side is another wall closing in, and it's the Roman law, which says that no one occupied by the Romans can pass the sentence of death upon another person. The Jewish people who were occupied, they cannot enact the capital punishment. Only the Roman state could. Hence how the passion played out and Jesus' death. And so here's this trap they had set. So clever. Because no matter what Jesus says, he's going to be violating one of the laws or the other. But human scheming and cleverness It has nothing over the wisdom of God. And Jesus passes right through them with what he says in response. First, he leans down and he writes upon the ground. And he stands and he says to them, "Let the one without sin cast the first stone." He takes this trap, he turns it right back upon them. Because here is them in this no-win situation, and they begin to realize it. Because here they were, the Pharisees and scribes, who were the ones who put themselves forward as being without sin. They practiced the law to the T, to perfection. And so, if they throw the stone because they are without sin, they're condemning themselves by Roman law, that they are breaking the Roman law and this crime, to which they then would be put to death. If they don't throw a stone, they're admitting to sin, and thus being condemned by God's own law. Do you see what Jesus did? He turned the thing back upon them, that no matter what they do, they don't win. And he leans back down and he begins to write on the ground. What is he writing? We do not know. There's theories, though. One of the powerful ones is that upon the ground and in the dirt, he was writing their names, which they would have recognized as being a greater condemnation. He is writing their names in the dirt than even the charge of hypocrisy. That it would be a fate worse than even the dual ones that they'd faced otherwise, if they threw a stone or if they didn't. Because the scribes and the Pharisees, they knew the scriptures inside and out, and they would have known Jeremiah 17:13, which is a section in which the prophet Jeremiah, it's a section which is entitled "The Source of Life." And it says that those who reject the Lord will have their names written in the dust, because they have left the Lord, the spring of living water. And that the condemnation upon them would be like the condemnation of the serpent after the fall, who was condemned to crawl upon the dust for the rest of his days. And their condemnation would be that in which they would return from that which they had come to the dust. It was a trap, but it was a trap that Jesus had turned back upon them. The scandal. Within the early church, in the first couple centuries, as the canon of scripture was being formed, right, there were all these writings, and it was the church that formed what was actually the Word of God. There was a great many in the Christian communities who saw this part of the Gospel of John. They accepted the Gospel of John, but they said this part, they didn't believe it could be authentic. And so they had said, and they themselves, many were from the Greek-speaking world, that this should be left out of the Gospel of John. Why? Because they saw it as Jesus excusing sin. Yeah, he says, go and sin no more, but he's essentially excusing it. This, one of the gravest sins, a sin that destroys so much, that it destroys the person. It destroys marriages, family. It destroys children, the sin of adultery. And so they said there's no way this could have actually been a part of John. It was added in. Well, my boy Augustine, he disagreed with them. St. Augustine. And so did the church, based largely off of what Augustine argued. He said, quote, "Jesus came not to destroy those he found, but Jesus came with a direct mission to destroy sin." And he came to seek those who were lost so that those who were found might be lost to sin. That Jesus had been pursuing this woman. And even in the midst of that night before all this happened, in the midst of everything unfolding, he was at the Mount of Olives and he was pursuing her in his prayers and in his tears so that he could restore her and recreate her so that she could go and sin no more and pursue not sin, but now pursue him. St. Paul in his letter speaks of this funny term of being possessed by Christ. When we think of possession, we always think of it in the negative sense, right? Demonic possession. There's another possession as well, and it's the one that St. Paul speaks about. He's talking here about recognizing everything of his past, which is horrid, right? Paul, who just tried to destroy the Christian community. Paul, who was guilty of murder of Christians. That he looks at everything that he had done, all of his sin, and everything else, and sees it as mere rubbish for the sake of being able to pursue Jesus Christ. And that he hasn't yet perfectly possessed Jesus. He's not perfect yet in this maturity, he says, but he's pursuing it so that he might be possessed by Jesus Christ. That he might not dwell on the sins of his past. That he's not sitting there thinking all the time, oh, how horrible I am, how awful. But rather, like what Isaiah says, remember not the events of the past, for the Lord is doing something new. That he's not to dwell in the sins of his past, but the Lord has recreated him, literally given him a new vision. And that now he is possessed, his will and his heart is possessed by the love of God. And this is what pursues him and presses him forward. And that her punishment as well, the final thing that Augustine and the Church Fathers point out, her punishment as well is not just overlooked, but rather it's the punishment that Jesus himself would take upon himself when he returns to the Mount of Olives and begins what would be his passion. The Mount of Olives, where he would sweat tears of blood from his body upon the dirt, and he would begin the recreation of all sin, the recreation of all sinners, and the forgiveness of their sin. Finally, the last stone. You know, when something happens once, that might be pretty amazing. That's really neat. Something happens once. Something happens twice, that could be a coincidence. It's interesting. But when something happens 3, 4, 5 times, now you have a pattern. And then when you see something and hear from others that they recognize the same pattern, it's something to pay attention to. And so what I offer to you in this is just an anecdote, but it's a pattern of them. I've been a priest now for nearly 12 years. And in those 12 years, I've had a number of people, it's been a great grace, in spiritual direction. And you know, people come to spiritual direction, and one of the things that a lot of people carry is they'll carry still the weight of a great sin from their past. They'll carry the shame of it. They've confessed that sin. They've been forgiven of it. But yet they're not free from it, and they carry it around as a great weight, and it's a great weight of shame. And one of the gospel passages that very early on I would give to them to pray with, and I'd say, just sit with this and just pray with it, even if it's just reading through it, and whatever happens in your mind, in your heart, anything, just sit with this gospel passage. And when you come back the next time, we'll talk about it. And a pattern that happens with this so often is maybe after a time or two of them sitting and praying with this gospel passage, I'll ask them, well, what did you see while you were praying with it? And they'd explain it. And I'd say, well, was anyone holding stones to condemn you with and to stone you with? Well, there was just one. Or was it someone in your life? No, it wasn't them. Was it Jesus holding a stone, ready to condemn you, or ready to just watch if you slipped up again? No, it wasn't Jesus. And so I'd ask, who was holding the last stone? And there's a pattern in which so often you know who it is. The person they find holding the last stone is themselves. That they're holding this last stone of condemnation. And this begins this realization of this truth. It begins the process of being freed from it and not possessed by the past and possessed by their sin, but the process of slowly becoming possessed by the love and the mercy of Jesus Christ. To not be trapped by their sin, but pursued and possessed by Jesus. To experience their name as not written in the dirt and not dirt itself, but their name spoken from the lips of Jesus as he spoke their name when he created them, as every time that when Jesus created you, he spoke your name and he spoke you into existence, speaking your name and forming you from the dust of the ground and breathing life into you, that their name is restored and they become recreated so that they can leave behind what was in the past and pursue forward and strive for Jesus Christ and to be possessed and their heart possessed by him and their whole life possessed by the love of Jesus Christ, which frees us and helps us to live entirely in his mercy.